Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Neil Nymark. I'm a board-certified family physician and founder of the Academy of Stress Mastery. And I want to welcome you to this tape on attitudes and beliefs and how they affect stress. And for this tape, I'm going to take you back to a live talk that I gave that has really a wonderful, wonderful presentation on attitudes and beliefs that I think you're going to find incredibly helpful in terms of reducing stress and improving your health and emotional well-being. So I'm going to take you back there now to the live talk and enjoy. And don't forget to take notes and really write down those principles and ideas that strike you that are going to really help you to make a difference in achieving a level of stress mastery in your life. Okay, take care and enjoy the talk.
My name is Dr. Nymark, and I'm a family practitioner here in Irvine, California, and I have a very busy and full practice in family medicine. And I also have a long-held interest in the mind and the body, and that began long ago when I was doing my internship, and I became very ill myself from a case of mono that I know came on because I was terribly unhappy at my program, and I didn't find the kind of support that I had hoped, and it didn't turn out to be the type of a medical training that I had hoped. There was very little hands-on emotional connection with patients and people, and it was very much a matter of doing what we call lovingly scut work for the attendings, and no sleep, and being up 100-hour weeks. And so that eventually drained me, and I came down with a case of mono. And I knew it was because I became depressed first, that I woke up one day and just couldn't really function anymore. And that was kind of my entry into the world of the mind-body connection on a very personal level. And I took two years off after my internship to sort of get my thoughts together, decide if medicine was what I really wanted to do. And in fact, during that time, I went up to Boston to live for a couple of years, and I got to study at some courses with Herbert Benson, who the keynote speaker spoke about today, who's probably the leading advocate of mind-body medicine, in my estimation anyway, that I've ever met. And he's a brilliant man. And Joan Borisenko, who's written many books on the subject. So these were some of my teachers in the early years. This was back almost 15 years ago. And that's how we all got started. That's how I got started in this area, so I have a very personal interest in it. And the director of the program wanted to tell me that maybe the virus caused me to be depressed, and you know, he was going to check all the biochemistries in my blood and everything. And I knew quite intuitively that it was the exact opposite, that our emotions and the feelings and the attitudes and beliefs that we hold dramatically affect our physical health. And we'll talk a little bit about that today in this model that I developed called the Health Mug. But first, I want to thank you all for coming, and thank you for giving me the opportunity today to share with you some thoughts on the healing power of attitudes and beliefs. I believe that attitudes have everything to do with how we experience life, both in adversity and in joyous times. And a simple demonstration of that power of positive attitudes comes from a story that Zig Ziglar used to tell. I don't know how many of you know him, but he's an inspirational, motivational speaker in the business realm. And he tells the story of the young boy who came home from school and went to his father and said, "Dad, I have some bad news. I'm afraid that I failed my math test." And the father looked at his son and goes, "Son, that's no way to think. You got to be positive, son. You got to have a positive attitude." And the boy thought for a minute, and he said, "Dad, you know, you're right. I'm positive I flunked my math test." On that note, we're going to proceed to the talk. And there are three basic premises that I developed for today's talk. And they are, one, that we have the ability to choose our attitudes and beliefs. We have the ability to choose our attitudes and beliefs. Number two, that positive attitudes are empowering. Positive attitudes are empowering, and they increase our capacity for health, happiness, and well-being. And the corollary of that is that negative attitudes are disempowering, and they diminish our capacity for health, happiness, and well-being. And the third premise of today's talk is that the attitudes and beliefs that we hold represent forces of the human mind that are no less powerful than a physician's prescription pad. That the attitudes and beliefs we hold represent forces of the human mind that are no less powerful than a physician's prescription pad. And what that means is that we can direct the power of our thoughts, our attitudes, and our beliefs towards greater health and healing. And I'm going to take these one at a time and we'll go through them. The first, we have the ability to choose our attitudes and beliefs. In fact, what happens is that if we don't choose them, often they're chosen for us, right? Many of the attitudes and beliefs that lead to illness or to unhappiness or to excessive stress or suffering in our lives come from places we don't even know where they came from. And that's why it's hard work to examine these attitudes. Because if we don't choose them for ourselves, many times they come from families, from relationships, from the way we were raised, things we unconsciously picked up, things we learned as children. Many of these things that we learned as children are attitudes or beliefs that we carry today that we haven't really consciously chosen. And the way to healing and the way to health is clearly to proactively be able to examine our choices, our attitudes, our beliefs for ourselves. You know, in the animal world, they say it's eat or be eaten, right? You've all heard that? In the human world, what we say in the spiritual world, it's define or be defined. That if we fail to define for ourselves who we are, the values that we cherish and hold true, and the attitudes and beliefs that come from those values, then we put ourselves at risk for being defined by others. And it may be illness that defines us. In fact, illness is oftentimes a wake-up call to begin to look at our attitudes. There's a wonderful physician in Northern California, Rachel Naomi Remen, and she runs the Commonweal Cancer Program up there. She has a wonderful new book out, by the way, called Kitchen Table Wisdom. And what she says is illness is often a wake-up call, that illness has become a form of Western meditation, that until we face disease or illness, we often don't look at the underlying issues that are running our lives. So it's very important that we understand this concept, that it's a matter of choice. There's a wonderful cartoon, I don't have it with me, but I'll describe it to you. It shows a caveman and he's building a fire. He's rubbing two sticks together, he finally gets the spark and there's fire. And next to him is a caveman with a little stone pad and a chisel, and he seems to be recording the event. And he says to the man starting the fire, "How shall I refer to you in my chronicles? As the discoverer of fire or as the first person to pollute the atmosphere?" You see, the choice is ours. But we have to make that choice. There's always a different way of seeing the world. And it's critical, the choices we choose, because it affects our attitudes, it affects our behaviors, and it affects the very fabric of our physiology and our biochemistry. And the keynote speaker spoke a little bit today about those messenger molecules, and those thoughts and those feelings are translated into biochemistry. Well, what leads us to choose the beliefs and the attitudes that we hold? It has to do with the information that we've learned growing up or acquired from our life experience. And it has to do with the perceptions that we carry. And one of the most exquisite cartoons I ever saw in perceptions was this one right here. I've kind of roughly drawn it out for you. And we have these two men, and these are actually, for this example, buckets of water. So this man on the right has his right hand in a 20-degree bucket and his left in the 40, and the man to his side has his right in the 40 and his left in the 60. So this guy's saying, it's hot. This guy's saying, it's cold. Which is it? It's both. It's both. In fact, one of the key sort of attitudes of spiritual development in that realm of the mind and the body and spiritual integration is that we're not either or. As human beings, as spiritual beings, we're not either or, we're both and. And this tendency to compare our experience, okay, is a really a Buddhist concept, the comparing mind. And what it leads us to is a lot of unnecessary stress, a lot of unnecessary suffering, because there's no hope to ever escape this cycle of comparing. And comparing really leads to suffering on many levels. So that imagine in our society this is not temperature anymore, but imagine this represents thousands of dollars. So this guy's thrilled, I'm rich. This guy, I'm poor. I'm successful. I'm a failure. You see, we have to realize that the perceptions that we hold and the tendency to compare, we need to evaluate where those comparisons come from. And that requires a very deep and honest examination of ourselves, looking inside which bucket are we comparing our experience to? And we know, for example, that we can change perceptions. Robert Ader, who is a cardiologist, and he wrote a wonderful book called Is It Worth Dying For? And what he said, he gave this example, I heard a tape of his once, and it goes like this. Imagine, take a moment and imagine the person you're most angry with right now. Somebody that's really messed up your life or angered you or frustrated you or made your life difficult. Take a minute and just close your eyes and imagine that person and all the feelings of anger and frustration you have about them. Tell me when you got it. Okay? Now, I want you to imagine that you just found out that this person has a brain tumor and that nothing that they said and nothing that they did was their choice, that it was beyond their control. It was a matter of the structure of this tumor. It affected what they said, it affected what they did. How many of you feel a change in what you feel towards that person? You see, when they polled people, they found that 85% of people experienced more compassion and more understanding for that person. 15% said they wished it would grow faster. But, you know, we can't take care of everybody here. In any case, one of the best ways I know to change perceptions and to shift attitude, when we talk about we have the ability to choose our beliefs and attitudes, is to look for the blessing in things. To look for the gift, so that when we're up against difficult times, we can take it personally and we can become upset about it, or we can look for the blessing, the gift for us. Because what if things are the way that they're supposed to be? And what if everything that happens to us has an ultimate benefit for us? And that instead of resisting and fighting, that we get to choose, we get to have the opportunity to discover what that blessing is and what that benefit is. Biblically, the story of Jacob and the angel or the stranger, this is another beautiful illustration of the blessing. I don't know if you remember when he fights his battle with the angel or the stranger and actually pulls the hip from the socket, and the angel goes to leave, and Jacob will not let go, and he says, I will not let you loose till you bless me. And that blessing is what we're looking for, to look for the blessing in the adversity. That this gives us the shift of perception so that we can adopt the attitudes and beliefs that are healing. Okay, we're going to move on to the next principle, which is positive attitudes and beliefs are empowering, and they increase our capacity for health, happiness, and peace of mind. Carl Simonton did much of the great original groundbreaking work with cancer patients. He wrote a book called Getting Well Again, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's going through any serious life-threatening illness. He originally studied 152 cancer patients and rated those patients on their attitude towards treatment. He followed them for 18 months. And the results were very clear. He found that those with positive attitudes had better responses to treatment. Those with negative attitudes had poorer responses. In fact, only two of those 152 people with negative attitudes had positive responses. And what they found out was very simple. A positive attitude towards treatment was a better predictor of response to treatment than was the severity of the disease. It's amazing when you really think of it, that a positive attitude towards the treatment was a better predictor of response than the severity of the disease. You know how many times we get stuck in statistics? Like she spoke a little bit today about statistics, that how often we're told we have X percent of recovery, or, you know, these are the odds. And to think that we can influence with the attitude towards treatment was a better predictor of any statistic your doctor is going to be able to give you. And that's not true of all diseases. You know, I think one very important concept that I haven't talked about yet, but I want to make sure we get out in the open. There are unknown elements in the healing equation. You know, perfectly good people die for no apparent reason at all. People with the most positive attitudes and the best people we could imagine. Okay? And likewise, there are people who do everything against the odds and they seem to survive to the end. Some kind of strange Murphy's Law. Children are born with cancer. Okay? Clearly, there are many, many illnesses that are way beyond the power of our attitudes and beliefs. But what's always within our reach is the ability to generate the most possible out of that moment, out of what is available to us, okay? So a cure is not always possible. And what we're talking about here is moving beyond a cure into the healing response, which is the essence of becoming more whole, more loving in life. That's to me, the number one thing. So that's what we're really looking at, that sense of acceptance of who we are. So I want to put that in perspective. Does that make sense to everybody? Because you can get overboard here, and there's a lot of anger floating around between alternative and traditional, and I think everybody's trying to do the best they can, but we need to remember that there are serious illnesses for which there are no cure, and we don't want to generate guilt because we think that we brought these illnesses on. That's a whole nother subject too, is the, you know, this new age guilt. The fact that, well, if my thoughts can get me well, did I cause my disease? And that's not a healthy attitude. The healthy attitude is to say, you know what, this happened. And now I can look at my attitudes, look at my beliefs and the choices I've made, and begin to get well again. But the blame is out. There's no blame. We don't cause diseases. We may participate in them. We might participate in becoming vulnerable to them, but we don't cause them. It's much more complicated than that. So the attitude towards treatment was a better predictor of response to treatment than was the severity of the disease. Let me show you how important attitudes are. I'm going to take some attitudes from his book and let me share them with you. These are things that they discuss with their cancer patients when they first enter the program. Tell me which one of these attitudes do you think is going to provide a better a milieu or environment for healing. Attitude number one, cancer is synonymous with death. Attitude number two, the positive side of that, cancer is a disease that may or may not be fatal. Do you see the shift? Do you see the difference? Attitude number two, cancer is something that strikes from without and there is no hope of controlling it. That's a belief, okay? That's a choice. Here's another choice. The body's own defenses can destroy cancer cells no matter what the cause. Which one of those attitudes do you think are going to allow you to heal better? Allow your treatments to work, your chemotherapy to be beneficial. Third attitude, medical treatment is drastic, ineffective, and has negative side effects. The flip side of that attitude, medical treatment is an important ally in support of body defenses. You see how these subtle shifts in beliefs change our whole attitude towards the disease? That suddenly there's hope? Let me give you one last one. Cancer cells are strong and undefeatable. Here's the flip side. Cancer cells are weak and confused. In fact, cancer cells are weak and confused. They're cells that have no sense of communication or connection with any other cells in the body. They're dumb. They're just confused and weak cells, okay? You can imagine a patient who has cancer having the idea that they're strong and undefeatable versus they're weak and confused. These shifts in attitude and belief are so critical because they decide whether there's hope or not, whether things we can do can help. And these shifts in belief give us hope, and hope is a vital pathway to our healing system. In fact, the process of getting well includes redefining our attitudes and beliefs about illness so that there is hope. Hope is a powerful biochemical prescription, okay? And that I believe that we as doctors and healers of all kinds have a responsibility to help inspire patients in any strategy for a full recovery, to help them to acquire the hope that they need. And some people ask, is this false hope? Is it false hope? Norman Cousins is a great answer to that. He says that we need to be as concerned about fostering false fear as false hope. And that what we find out when we realize the power of the attitudes and beliefs we had and the power of hope, that hope acts as such a powerful biochemical prescription, that we see that errors in the attitudes and beliefs we choose can be no less devastating than mistakes in medication or surgery. That the errors in the attitudes we choose can be no less devastating than mistakes in medication or surgery. Let me give you a couple of very interesting examples of the power of belief. One is by Carol Butler and Andrew Steptoe. This is University of London, published in Clinical Psychology. They did a fascinating experiment. They took a group of patients that have asthma, and they divided them into two groups. To both groups, they said, we're going to give you a pill that we know will cause constriction of your lungs and cause your asthma to get worse, okay? But to one of the groups only, they said, we're going to pre-treat you with a special new drug that we have that will prevent the constriction from the first drug. So this group was going to be pre-treated so that they could prevent it. And in fact, they gave both groups plain water, sterile water. And what they found is exactly what you're all smiling about, that the group that was pre-treated had no deterioration in their lung function. And the group that was not pre-treated had bronchial constriction and their asthma suffered and they got worse. And this is a fascinating case where bronchial constriction, a physiological process, was both caused by and prevented by the power of belief in the same study. It's just fascinating. There's an anecdotal report, and this goes way back to the 1950s. There was a new drug called cribiazin, and this was receiving a lot of national publicity as a possible cure for cancer. And this was being researched by Dr. Klopfer. And one of his patients found out he was working on this drug, and they basically had a very advanced lymphosarcoma, a lymphoma of the body. And he was in a desperate physical condition. His lungs were filling up with fluid frequently, and the patient had to get fluid drained off. He needed oxygen. And he was very debilitated by his physical condition. He begged Dr. Klopfer to include him and to give him this drug. Klopfer agreed, and the results were really remarkable. Within weeks, this patient's tumor masses disappeared. The chest tumors were gone. The fluid was gone. He resumed a normal life. And this continued for several months till the AMA and the FDA started to publish reports on the initial results of cribiazin. And what they found is it wasn't living up to its expectations. So in fact, the patient read these reports that the drug was no longer as effective as they thought. And within weeks, his condition demised again. The tumors regrew. Fluid reaccumulated in his lungs. And he was in a desperate state again. Well, Dr. Klopfer heard of this this situation, and he felt that extreme measures were justified. And he approached the patient and he said, "Listen, I've developed a new super refined double strength cribiazin that we're getting much better results with than the initial one." And in fact, it was plain water again. He gave this drug to the patient, and the recovery was even more miraculous than the first time. Within days, the tumors melted, the fluid cleared, and the patient resumed a normal life. Till approximately 3 to 4 months later, when the final reports on cribiazin came out, and the national headlines read something to the effect of cribiazin found to be a useless drug in the treatment of cancer. And within days, the patient had died. Now, even though this is only an anecdotal report, I think it points out the dramatic, maybe it's a coincidence, you know, but I don't think any of us really believe it. It just points out the dramatic force of the attitudes and beliefs we hold. Somehow the human mind is able, and Norman Cousins was responsible for this idea, and a great teacher, miss him dearly, and he was a phenomenal humanitarian. If you ever get to read any of his books, Anatomy of an Illness, hear any of his tapes, I highly recommend it. He said that the human mind converts our ideas and expectations into biochemical realities. And that's exactly true. There's some inner pharmacy within us. There's some mechanism by which our positive emotions, hope, love, the will to live, the anticipation of a loving experience trigger, act as a biochemical prescription that goes to this inner pharmacy somewhere within our minds and our bodies. And these chemicals that heal us are produced. We don't know the exact mechanism, but we probably one day will find out more and more. But we need to remember the power of these attitudes and beliefs. I'm going to go to the corollary of that second premise, and that is that negative attitudes and beliefs are disempowering, and they diminish our capacity for health, happiness, and peace of mind. Now, one area that we just spoke about, the power of positive belief, is really also called the placebo effect. And she talked about that a little in the session this morning. But it actually means to please, that it was felt that the beneficial effects were because the patient wanted to please the doctor and wanted to do well so that, you know, the situation would be friendly and everybody would be happy. The opposite of the placebo effect is called the nocebo effect. Nocebo comes from the same root as like toxic or toxin. And our beliefs can work against us as well, as you saw in this story on cribiazin. But take, for instance, this experiment by J.W. Fielding at the Department of Surgery, Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Birmingham, England. They studied 411 patients were going to chemotherapy. So they were advised about the possible side effects of the drugs. And they were all told to expect hair loss. Well, what happened was that 30% of these patients unknowingly received a placebo. And guess what happened? Right, their hair fell out. Okay? That's the nocebo effect. They received nothing more than an inert, inactive pill. Who knows what it was? Salt, sugar. That's the nocebo effect. There are more dramatic individual examples and anecdotal reports of patients, for instance, who highly allergic patients who sneeze at a presentation of fake roses or fake flowers, you know. Larry Dossey is a doctor, an internist, I think from Texas, and he's written many books that are wonderful, Meaning in Medicine, Recovering the Soul. And he tells the story of a patient who was highly allergic to penicillin. This patient was given an inert pill, and they were incorrectly, at a later date, told, a later moment, told that they were given penicillin. And within minutes, this patient went into a panic reaction, became fearful, started to convulse, and died. Because the panic that can be generated by fear and by the negative emotions can be so strong and overwhelming. So to him, this patient is no less dead because he only believed it was penicillin. Okay, it's the belief. Those beliefs are powerful. So we need to be somewhat watchful of negative thinking. And I'll try and break it up with a little humorous story that I heard the other day, actually read in the magazine, about a negative thinker. There was this person who decided to join a monastery, and this was a particular monastery where they had to take a vow of silence. And at this particular monastery, every 7 years, you get to speak two words. So the patient took his vows, and he went away to his room, and 7 years passed, and then they brought him out before the panel of the high priests, and they said, "You've now been 7 years silent. You've earned the right to say two words. What would you like to say?" And he says, "Cold floors." They say, "Thank you very much." They send him back to his room. Another 7 years pass. Silence. He comes out before the panel. They say, "You've earned another two words. What would you like to say?" He says, "Bad food." Say, "Thank you very much." They send him back to the room. 7 more years pass. He comes back in front of the panel of high priests. They say, "You've earned another two words. What would you like to say?" He says, "I quit." And they go, "You know, we're not surprised. You've done nothing but complain since you got here." Okay, on to the third premise. The attitudes and beliefs that we hold represent forces of the human mind that are no less powerful than a physician's prescription pad. So what does this mean? It means we can direct our attitudes towards greater health and healing, just as we can direct a penicillin tablet towards the treatment of strep throat. That we have the ability to control the power of these attitudes and beliefs we carry and direct them towards our healing. And Simonton's Getting Well program, his cancer program, is one of the ways that we do that. And there are many, many. The Mind-Body Institute of Herbert Benson, who she spoke about today, who's one of my teachers and a very inspirational leader in the field up in Boston. And he has a whole Mind-Body Institute, and they've published a wealth of research on how we can begin the process of examining our attitudes and beliefs and our choices and directing those powerful forces towards our own healing in an integrative way. How do these attitudes and beliefs really affect our physical health? I want to show you a model that I developed years ago that will help you to sort of understand in a picture form what's happening in the body. It doesn't describe the exact mechanisms, but it gives you a good feel for the basic principles. This is called the health mug. I called it the health mug. I actually designed this to show people how two people can be exposed to the same virus or bacterial illness, and one will get ill and the other won't, okay? That this mug represents we all are born with a certain capacity for health and for wellness, okay? And that's represented by the space in this mug. Now, certain things take up space in our mug already. We're born with certain things we can't change, like our sex, our family history, our age, and our genetics. Now, we also carry certain things that we can change. These have to do with lifestyle issues up here, poor diet, high stress, lack of exercise, workaholism, and then some emotional issues, guilt, sadness, fear, resentment, anger, grief. You can add hundreds more in there. And then here, what I've sort of called the core spiritual elements that take up space in our mugs are shame, low self-esteem, a sense of isolation or unworthiness. So we have a certain amount of our mug that's utilized by the things that we carry, the stuff that we carry around, the unfinished business, the stresses, the demands of life. Now, the room that's left is our capacity to fight off dis-ease, or our capacity for health, happiness, and well-being, or peace of mind. That's the room that's left. The other thing that's important to understand here is that our health is always being threatened by forces outside of us. So we're always being exposed to certain virus and bacteria, toxins in the environment, emotional toxins, other people's anger, guilt, unsafe sex, behavioral issues that we bring on ourselves. So let's imagine that we have that it's a very difficult time in your life and you've got a tremendous amount of stress and your mug's filled up even higher than this one is, almost to the brim. And in comes this little bacteria. Okay, you're in the elevator with someone, they sneeze, and oh my God, and boom, the bacteria plops like an ice cube in your mug, it overflows, and when it overflows, that's when we develop stress-related disease. And this time, you're going to get a cold. But it could be irritable bowel syndrome, it could be migraine headaches, it could be rashes, it could be hives, it could be any number of physiological conditions, okay? So now let's say that life is more calm for you. Let's say 3 months have passed and you know you've taken care of your diet, you've changed your job, you got out of a toxic relationship or a toxic job, and now you have all this room in here. This same virus or bacteria plops into the cup and it falls in, and this time there's plenty of room, so there's no overflow, no stress-related disease. It gives you a good visual picture of what William Osler said, who was the first chief of medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He said that it's much more important to know what sort of patient has the disease than what sort of disease the patient has. Now, I heard her quote Hippocrates, but I don't think it was Hippocrates. I think it was William Osler. And again, it's much more important to know what sort of patient has the disease than what sort of disease the patient has. And so you can see, let's even take an external toxin, maybe a cancer-causing toxin. Something comes into the system and it creates the possibility of cancer. If we are very stressed out, if we haven't dealt with our emotions and worked on our sense of sadness or unfinished business, that toxin may come at a time when it causes disease. In fact, we know the number one precursor of cancer is a sense of hopelessness and helplessness. When you examine cancer patients, not every one of them again, but the majority of people that you can find some cause, 6 to 18 months prior to the development of the cancer, they experienced a depression, a hopelessness, or a helplessness. Their mugs were filled up, and suddenly, the body's own ability to handle the normal cancer cells that develop all the time in our system, but we fight them off daily. That's called the immune surveillance theory. We fight and destroy cancer cells every day in our body. We have abnormal cells. But when our bodies are exhausted and our energy is exhausted, we have no energy left to fight them. So there are more cancer cells being developed because our immune system's weakened, and our immune system has less ability to take care of them. So it's very important to notice a couple of things. That when we heal our attitudes and beliefs, when we go to work on some of this unfinished business and get to the underlying fear or grief that we hold on to, we have to have an outlet for that. We have to find a way to release it from our bodies. And there are many, many ways. There are group therapy, there's programs, there's journaling, there's listening to tapes. There are many ways to begin this process of release. But often you notice when we do release, it comes out as tears. It comes out as sadness and grief. And this is the way we begin to open up to the healing that's available to us. That grief and sadness is really the energy to say goodbye. And we have to say goodbye to things that didn't turn out the way we hoped. If we're holding on to those resentments or angers, they're going to tie up our energy. And when we say goodbye, we can allow new things to come into our lives. I'm going to sing you one more song about this process of releasing, because a lot of people don't know how to be with others who are going through difficult times when they're feeling a lot of emotions. And we feel like we need to fix it, or we're supposed to do something, or don't cry, or don't, you know. And what I've learned and what the literature supports is there's a place of just being there. That just the sharing that sense of grief with someone and being there to hold them and to support them is vital and critical to healing. That sense of connection is what heals us. So we don't need to do anything. We just need to be present. We just need to be aware of what the person is going through and be there for them. So we tend to our emotional unfinished business, okay? We begin that process. Now, the other thing is we need to guard this entrance to our mugs, okay? Because people love to throw their stuff in there. Anybody, you know these people? They love to throw their guilt in there. They love to throw their anger in there. People love to toss things in your mug because they get to blame you and they get to get it out of their way. So what you want to do is be able to watch out what you let in. Now, George Solomon is a psychiatrist at UCLA who's done a lot of research on mind-body. He's done research on stress and immunity. What he found in his study was that the most surprising correlation for the strongest immune system, the number one factor determining the strong immune system, was the ability to say no to a request for a favor. People are smiling and some are... Can you believe that? This most surprising correlation was the ability to say no to the request for a favor. And that's because we have to set boundaries, that it's very important that what we let in here is what we choose to let in. These are where toxic beliefs can come in here, too. I don't have any listed here, although some of them correlate. But, you know, we really have to, part of the process of loving well and learning emotional healing and taking care of ourselves is the ability to set limits and boundaries. I mean, they've done studies on rheumatoid arthritis patients, twin sisters. One gets rheumatoid and one doesn't. I don't know how many. There were at least 30 to 40 twin sisters that they did these studies on. The overwhelming predictor, the difference between the personalities of the two, was the inability of the one with arthritis to express anger. The inability, really, to set boundaries and express their anger or say no, that's enough, or set a limit. So that inflammation stays in the body. And what is inflammation in the body? I mean, it's arthritis. They've done also interesting study on rheumatoid arthritis as well as patients. They've talked about journaling and the writing, the just putting out on paper. Because see, when we put words to these feelings, and one of the ways we can do that is by sharing in groups, therapy, group therapy, or just writing and journaling. When patients wrote for 15 minutes, only 4 days, for 15 minutes a day about really revealing things about themselves and their feelings and their hurt and their anger and their frustrations, that they showed tremendous improvement in their symptoms and signs, objectively evaluated by physicians for up to 6 months, writing 4 days. And this was just published in JAMA, but there have been many studies on this. So we really want to begin this process of looking at what's filling up our mug, at setting appropriate boundaries so we don't let unnecessary stresses and toxicity in. We're kind of running out of time, so I want to end here, and I just want to leave you with this story. It's a big commitment to begin this work. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of hard work to begin this process of looking inside ourselves and becoming aware so that we can change our attitudes and improve our health. And there's a wonderful story about commitment of the two women who were talking to one another. And the one says to the other, you know, I've been waiting so long to get married, but now that I'm actually engaged, I'm scared to death. I'm really frightened. And her friend turns to her and she says, you know, you should be scared. Getting married is a very big commitment. 7 or 8 years can be a very long time. A dismaying joke about the state of life. That was terrible. I apologize. I apologize. But I want to thank you all for the privilege of speaking here today and sharing some of my thoughts and research. And I do wish you all the courage and the strength that it takes to choose empowering beliefs. And I hope that you have the strength to choose the ones that give you the health and the happiness and the peace of mind that you all deserve, and that's your own natural inheritance. So thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you.